Hey guys, I hope everyone's doing well today. I have some really exciting news to share, which is that today marks my 15th episode. Yay! I can't believe it. I'm not sure if I ever told this story, but I started this podcast back in July of last year because I needed a hobby, you know, something to focus my efforts on besides COVID. A podcast like legit costs no money, and I've always absolutely loved true crime, so I figured, what the heck, I'll give it a go. Then at the same time, my son was super into TikTok, so I thought, oh my gosh, I am going to try a TikTok as well. And the TikTok actually turned out to be a really big win. So I love doing it now. But anyways, I just wanted to say thank you so much for all of the love and support that you guys have shown. I really, really appreciate it. I have no intention of stopping. I feel like I'm just getting ramped up. And that's it. So thank you. Thank you very much from the bottom of my heart. I appreciate it. Okay, so I think that's it for updates. All right, so on to the story, on to the main event. Today's story is crazy. I know I say this every single week, but I swear to you, this is another story that I had never heard of. I was shocked that I had never heard of this, and it was absolutely blown away. So that being said, you know the deal. If you are ready for a mind-blowing ride, sit back and buckle up, because this is the story of Butch and Brett Boyer. Forrest Boyer, who was affectionately known as Butch to his friends and family, was a 54-year-old local business owner and single father of a 12-year-old boy named William Brett Boyer. They called him Brett, though. Butch was the owner of Southern Auto Sales, which was a used car dealership. Butch was known for being an extremely hard worker. He was a good man who took his role as a single dad very seriously. Everything he did was to better Brett's life. He worked so incredibly hard so he could provide Brett with a nice home, nice clothes, and he even sent him to private school. Around 10 o'clock the night of February 17, 2002, Butch had just sat down at the kitchen table to do some paperwork when he heard a knock at the door. Now, he was a bit taken back by the knock because they weren't expecting anybody and it was getting late, but they lived in a safe area and he felt comfortable answering the door. Okay, quick pause for a story. A few months ago, this same exact thing happened to me. So my son and I were home alone watching a movie. It was about 10 o'clock and the same thing happens. There's a knock at the door and same, we live in a nice neighborhood, a nice area. I wasn't scared, but at the same time, I'm like, we're not expecting anybody. It's 10 o'clock at night. It's dark, like, what's up? You know what I mean? So yeah, it kind of scared me, but I walk up to the landing and I can like look through the glass without actually opening the door. And there's this young man standing there flailing his arms. It scared me even through the glass. It scared me so bad. So I kind of mouthed to him like, can I help you? Like, you know, what do you want type thing? And he starts freaking out, pointing at our garage. So I couldn't tell what he was saying, but he was legit panicked. And at first I thought he must have been in a car accident because I wouldn't say we live on a busy road, but we live on a road that is very windy. So it is not unusual for people to get in accidents like on our street. So I thought at first he needed me to call 911 for him, but he kept pointing at our garage, not the road. Anyhow, so I kind of twist my head like towards the garage and I see this yellow glow and I'm thinking, oh my God, the freaking aliens have made contact and they are at our home address. Just kidding. Although like 2% of me thought that. Just kidding. More like 5%. No, just joking. Anyways, but for real. So I open the door to get a better look because at this point, I know he's not like just trying to murder me. Like something was definitely wrong. So I peek the door open a bit, and my husband's truck is in flames. And I am not just talking about, like, you could see a flame coming out. Like, probably, and I'm really trying not to be dramatic here, so divide by two whatever I say, but probably, like, I don't know, 10 feet worth of flames. So again, that really equals five. But regardless, I'm not talking about, like, you could see smoke. Like, this baby was burning. It was crazy. So I have to tell you the funny part of the story, though, which is that my husband, who wasn't home at the time, was at the fire department for training night. So in other words, he was at the fire station training for a non-existent fire, and I was at home with an actual fire. So anyhow, I think, what did we do? I called 911. And my son, yeah, I wouldn't have told my son to call. Yeah, I called 911. My son called my husband. And then, like, of course, my husband was like, huh, what? So I later, like, once things had calmed down, I asked him, I'm like, how weird was it to get paged out to your own house? But anyway, I don't know. When I was reading this story, obviously the outcome of our story is much different. So I'm not comparing. But that initial reaction of someone knocking at your door at 10 o'clock when you're not expecting anybody. I had just recently lived through that. So, okay. Anyways, sorry for the side note. Now back to your regularly scheduled program. Okay. So remember, Butch had just sat down at the kitchen table to get caught up on paperwork when all of a sudden he hears a knock at the door, and it's about 10 o'clock at night. Again, he's a bit surprised, and they weren't expecting anybody, but he gets up, he walks to the front door, and he sees two policemen standing there, staring back at him. So, realizing it's the police, and of course feeling a little bit safer now, he opens the door, and just as he's about to ask, you know, like, what can I help you with, or what's going on, they shout at him, police, search warrant. Sure enough, these two cops who are standing there in uniform with badges and a search warrant in hand bust through the door and explain to him that they're from narcotics and he's now under arrest. They enter the house, they put Butch immediately in handcuffs, and they start searching. Now, this whole time, Butch is standing there saying, like, wait, what? Like, so confused. There must be a mistake. You have the wrong house. I don't use drugs. I certainly don't sell drugs. Like, what are you talking about? And he was making it known that they had the wrong guy. But again, narcotics officers issuing a search warrant are probably used to people saying, you have the wrong guy. So the cops didn't care at all. After some time, they walk Butch out to the car, who, remember, is in handcuffs, and they tell him they're taking him down to the station. As they're about to walk in, or put him into this unmarked cop car, Butch says, whoa, wait, hold on. What about my son? I have a 12-year-old little boy in the house right now. The cops are like, okay, well, we'll take him with us. So the cops go back in the house. They put the 12-year-old in handcuffs and bring him out to the car too. Honestly, I didn't even know cops could do that. Is that even legal to put a little kid in handcuffs who has done absolutely nothing wrong and is posing zero threat to you? I don't know. Anyways, he wasn't being combative or anything like that. He was just as confused as his dad was. So regardless, they put Butch and Brett in handcuffs in the backseat of the cop car. Butch started seriously panicking, though, when the cops drove past the police station. It's at this point that the light bulb turns on in Butch's head, and he realizes that these men were not cops. He and his 12-year-old son had just been abducted from their own home. So, they drive out to this remote area where they were in the process of building a 4-lane highway. At the time, though, it was all dirt. So, it was just two giant lanes, which eventually would be, of course, northbound, southbound, or eastbound, westbound, whatever. So no concrete, no lighting, no signs, no nothing. Just very dark, very secluded. Once they get to the specific area, the two kidnappers get Butch and Brett out of the vehicle and start asking Butch about a safe at his house and the $100,000 cash inside of it. Butch is like, huh? What are you talking about? I don't have a safe. I certainly don't have a safe with $100,000 in it. Like, he had no clue what these guys were talking about. Butch says, I do have some cash, and if you promise not to hurt us, I'll give you that cash. Like, just don't hurt me. Don't hurt my son. Just leave us alone. So the two men put Butch and Brett back into the car and drive right back to where they started from, which was Butch's front door. Butch walks them back to a closet in his bedroom and points to an old box sitting on one of the shelves. They open the box and find about $40,000 cash in it. Apparently $40,000 wasn't enough for these ass clowns, though, and they started demanding more. Brett's like, I don't have any more cash in the house. Like, P.S., who even keeps $40,000 cash in the house? Like, on a good night after payday, I might be able to scrape up 10 extra bucks that's laying around. You know what I mean? Anyways, on top of the $40,000 cash, so they also find the housekeeper's .38 caliber pistol. So just keep that in mind. So after getting the gun and the $40,000 cash, they drive back to the same location they had originally gone to, where the highway was being built. Butch and Brett are still handcuffed at this point and taken out of the car. Butch is begging at this point, please let my son go. I can get you more money in the morning when the banks open. Just please don't hurt us. Don't kill my kid. Don't kill my kid. I mean, over and over. You get the point. You can imagine. Any decent parent out there can imagine the fear that this man was feeling in this moment. Just then, Butch looks over and sees the scariest sight he could have imagined. He sees that these two men had already dug a shallow grave for them. Right then, they walk Butch away from the car towards this makeshift grave they had pre-dug for him, take out a knife, and slit his throat, ear to ear. The one who slit his throat then looks at Butch, and says, just go to sleep. As he lay there bleeding out and dying, 12-year-old Brett is screaming in the background, don't hurt my daddy, don't hurt my daddy, please don't hurt my daddy. Now, the guy who slit Butch's throat goes up to the other guy, the one who was watching Brett at the time, and says, I've killed one, now you kill one. The other guy takes out that .38 caliber that they had stolen from the housekeeper back at Brett and Butch's house and shoots this 12-year-old boy, Brett, in the head. Now, you guys know how I start to cry when I get upset about things. I can't help it. This brave young man did not die right away, and the guy who shot him shouts out to the other guy, this little, I can't even say it, so I'll just abbreviate, this little MF-er won't die, and he shoots him two more times. Sorry, again, I literally tried that three times, that's as best as we're gonna get. That was my third attempt at not crying, I can't help it. Anyways, it's at this point they realize that Butch is still alive, even after they had slit his throat for a second time. So after killing both, they dump Butch on top of Brett, who was already in the grave, along with the .38 revolver, dump lime all over them, bury them, and leave. The two men take off, having committed a damn near perfect murder. There was one problem, though. Butch Boyer was not dead. This freaking awesome man climbs around his deceased son, digs his way out of the grave. He had been holding his breath as best he could the entire time until the men drove away. Immediately, Butch pulls Brett out of the grave and starts CPR. For as long as he had strength in his body, he performed CPR until he just couldn't do it any longer. Now, my husband is a first responder. I don't know if I told you guys this. And he tells me all the time that giving CPR to someone is actually extremely tiring. So you think about that, plus everything Butch himself had just been through, it's unimaginable. I mean, really, it's unimaginable. He soon realizes that Brett is deceased, and he decides to make his way to the roadway and flags down a car. A man pulls over for Butch and calls 911. And I want you to hear part of that conversation.
Shot three times, is buried in a grave down here at Uchi, and he wants to go get him. He was buried and dug himself out. This is a bad one.
All right, so I should have specified what you just heard was the first officer on scene calling into dispatch. So that was Daryl Powell calling into dispatch to describe the scene. So he gets on with dispatch and tells them that you can see his Adam's apple, you can see his veins, and you can see that his actual throat is down on his chest. If you have the stomach for it, there is the cop had on his dash cam. So if you type in, what did I type in? I think I did Butch Boyer 911 call, I believe. If you have the stomach for it and you don't get too disturbed by that stuff, it is on YouTube, so you can see that. But anyhow, but the saddest part of this story was even after paramedics arrived, Butch absolutely refused to leave until they had located Brett. They were able to find Brett, who was confirmed, of course, to be deceased. I guess one of the cops was like, Butch, if you don't leave, you will die and we will never find out who did this. That's one of the only reasons Butch left the scene, was so Brett would eventually get justice. So Butch is actually able to tell the cops a lot of information. He tells them they were in a white Crown Vic with tinted windows. He gave the cops the approximate year of the vehicle, and he gave a critical piece of evidence. Butch, I don't even think he realized he was saying it. He sort of casually, I guess, said, they took the keys to my house. They're probably headed there now. So sure as crap, 20 minutes later, cops are surrounding the house, and who pulls up is a white Crown Vic near the Boyer's house. So this is where we are first introduced to 43-year-old Michael Carruth. Are you ready to have your mind blown? Guess what this POS does for a living? He's a freaking bail bondsman. Can you believe that? When I heard that, I was absolutely shocked beyond words. He also had no criminal record, which was interesting. But anyways, so they pull him out of the car and they find all sorts of evidence linking him to the crime. The car is still full of cash. They have, of course, the keys to Butch's home. There's blood on both his pants and shoes. There are handcuffs, shackles, police badges, and a police officer's hat. Needless to say, Michael Carruth is taken into custody. Right away, they start questioning this guy, and he just sits there, totally emotionless, and denies everything. In the back of his mind, he's thinking, I'm not sure why I'm here, but the only people who know what happened are dead. So the cops play their ace card and tell Michael that Butch Boyer is not dead. Michael Carruth's demeanor completely changes at this point, and when he hears this, the detectives said that you could, like, legit see the blood drain out of his face when he heard that news. Around the same time, Butch Boyer tells detectives something that will shock them to their core. Butch says he knows the second assailant. Butch says it's a 24-year-old man named Jimmy Lee Brooks Jr. Now, remember, Butch Boyer owned a used car lot, and Jimmy's father is a repo man. So Jimmy's father had worked for Butch a few times to repossess the cars of people who weren't making their payments. So just 12 hours later, police apprehend Jimmy Lee Brooks Jr. When they found him, he was actually outside standing next to a fire pit burning his clothes. He was at his own home when they found him, along with a large sum of money, and they also found some weed in the house. They bring him into the station, and right away, this guy starts singing like a canary. They didn't even have to push him before he started to confess to the crime. Here's what he says went down the months leading up to the murder. Jimmy Lee Brooks Jr. says that 6 months before that night, he had been arrested, and Michael Carruth, who remember is a bail bondsman, posted Jimmy's $35,000 bond to get him out of jail. As time goes on, though, to no one's surprise, Jimmy is not able to repay Michael Carruth back the money he owes him. And he tells him Carruth says, you pay me back or you're going to jail. And if you don't go to jail, your only other way out of this is to help me commit a crime. So Brooks then tells Carruth about a guy that his dad works for that has $100,000 cash in a safe at his house. Of course, the person being Butch Boyer. He even goes as far as to tell Carruth that he saw the money with his own two eyes, which of course was a lie. I don't know why he would do that. I guess just to sound credible so Carruth wouldn't send him back to jail. I don't know, but he makes up this lie saying, I've seen it with my own two eyes, it exists, which we know is a lie. I guess these two morons had decided to take the money they stole and start a pot farm. Like, what? Okay, you know? They decided this is how they would support their, you know, big business venture. Insert eye roll. Jimmy Lee Brooks says that they were going to leave the two alive, but cops called total BS on this since they had pre-dug a gravesite. Like, how do you explain that away? Also, they had lime with them. And I should have probably said it earlier when I was talking about the murder itself, but lime is used because it covers up the smell of decay. So oftentimes when you're hearing about a murder, the person will use lime. I've never seen it, to be quite honest. I think it's like a powder, and you like sprinkle it more or less over whatever you want, to not smell. So anyway, that's what I meant when I said the lime. So they had pre-dug this grave and they had purchased lime. So the cops were like, yeah, good try. This was totally pre-planned. Jimmy Lee Brooks also tells police that Michael Carruth is the one who slit the throat of Butch Boyer. And he himself, Jimmy Lee Brooks, admits to shooting 12-year-old Brett Boyer in the head. So now police have this full confession. And just as they're starting to wrap up the interview, Jimmy Lee Brooks drops a bombshell. He looks up and says to the detectives, I have something else to confess. We killed two other people a few weeks ago. Absolutely stunned, police sit back down, get comfy, and again, listen to Jimmy Lee Brooks start to sing. It turns out a few weeks prior in a nearby town called Opelika in Alabama, Michael Carruth had bailed another man out of jail. Just like Jimmy Lee Brooks Jr., 28-year-old James Edward Gary Jr. had gone to jail on a drug-related charge. When his family wasn't able to pull together the money to get him out, he called a bail bondsman for help. Unfortunately, he called the shadiest one in Alabama, none other than Michael Carruth. Carruth pulled the same crap with James Gary as he did with Jimmy Lee Brooks, which was, if you can't pay me back, you're either going to jail or you can pay me back another way, which is to help commit this crime. The other way in this situation was robbing 68-year-old Thurman and his wife, 62-year-old Catherine Ratliff. On January 30th, 2002, this is 17 days before the Boyer home invasion that you just heard about, Thurman and Catherine Ratliff's daughter, a woman named Katrina Ryan, drops her kids off at school and goes to work. Every single morning, without fail, she calls her mom, Catherine, at 8 a.m. And every single morning, without fail, Catherine Ratliff answers her daughter's call at 8 a.m. Katrina said each morning she would say the same thing. What are you doing? And her mom would say, drinking coffee, you? You can imagine the immediate concern when Katrina gets no answer. But she keeps herself in check and thinks, you know, it's no big deal. There's a reason, like, don't freak out. So she leaves a message for her parents to call her back, and she waits a bit, calls back again. Again, no answer. All right, so quick pause. Have you ever been in this position before? When you can't get in touch with somebody that you care about, it is like the scariest feeling. A few years ago, we were having this really bad winter storm. I was home, but my husband was still at work. Now, you have to know my husband's personality to really appreciate the story. He always has his phone on him. And he hates when I leave my phone somewhere and he can't reach me. Not because he's a psycho, but because he cares about me. So when he can't get in touch with me after trying for a long time, he worries, right? Normal husband thing to do. Okay, so knowing that, you can imagine how I felt when the roles were reversed. I had been calling him for about an hour and a half. It was getting late. It was dark. He knew that dinner would be ready about 6:30, and it was way past that time. So all indications were pointing in my mind to an accident. Anyways, I called once, but I didn't want to seem like a total nut job. So I waited 20 minutes. Then I called back, threw in a little text here and there. Still nothing, no response. Anyways, so all of a sudden, it's like all logic and reason in my head goes out the window and I start panicking. By the time that hour and a half was up, I was like on my knees, legit praying to God, like how I would be such a better wife. Please, like, don't let him be in a ditch somewhere dead. Like, please let me see him one more time. You know what I mean? All this crazy stuff. I was calling everyone he ever knew, like people who don't even live in the same state as us. Like, hey, yeah, it's Lee. Sorry to bother you. You haven't seen Michael by chance, have you? No? Yeah. Yeah, I know you moved to Alaska last year to study the left big toe of the last known Brazilian porcupines. Yeah, I know. I just wasn't sure if maybe you'd come home for a day and happen to be driving by our house in the last 30 minutes or so. No? Okay, cool. No problem. Just thought I'd ask. Sorry, that conversation went way too far, but you know what I mean, right? So you just lose all reason. So I could appreciate this woman's, again, I'm not trying to compare my story to hers. I'm just saying I try to relate to people's feelings, and I could imagine that she was trying to keep her cool, thinking, oh, they're probably at the store, they're probably outside, like anything. You don't want to jump to that worst case scenario, but I don't know why we do, but we do. Anyhow, in my story, for the record, or my situation, my husband had got stuck talking to somebody and he left his phone in the car while he was still inside of work. So he was fine. All was well. But anyway, okay. So by lunchtime, Katrina was beside herself. She was starting to freak out. So she asked her boss if she can leave work, go to her parents' house. Her boss, of course, says no problem. And she drives the 10 minutes to her mom and dad's house. When she arrived, she immediately notices both cars still in the driveway, but she could tell someone had kicked in the back door. She walked in and immediately sees her dad lying on the floor face down, blood all over his shirt. She starts yelling, "Dad, Dad," but she soon realizes that he's dead. She then runs down the hall yelling for her mom. She runs into her mom's bedroom, but finds her on the other side of the bed on the floor dead. And apparently it was obvious that she had been shot. So she ran back into the living room to call 911, but there was no dial tone. So she drives, they must have lived in a very rural area where you couldn't just walk to the neighbor's house, because it said that she drove to the next neighbor's home and says, "Someone killed my mom and dad, you know, please help me, call 911. So with the both excitement and a broken heart, this poor woman passes out as she's waiting on police to arrive. And I don't mean excitement like she was happy. I meant excitement of the situation, just everything going on. So police arrive and find that Thurman Ratliff had a gunshot wound to the hand, the lower back, and the head. Catherine, his wife, met the same fate with a gunshot wound to the shoulder and to the head. It was clear to police that the intruders were looking for something. They had been rummaging, searching. The attic ladder was pulled down. Vents for the air conditioning were open. Drawers were open. Cabinets had been rummaged through. They weren't very good, though, at their job, because police found $87,000 in cash hidden throughout the house. Forensics said a 9mm had been used, but from two different weapons. So early on in this investigation, police thought that there may be two offenders. Per the investigation, the detectives start digging into who the heck would have or could have done something like this. Right away, their daughter, Katrina, the one who found them, had an ex-husband that seemed super shady. Katrina and her husband were separated when the murders took place, but he had threatened to hurt Katrina and her family in the past. His name was Norman Herman, and he was known to be extremely violent and just a bad man. Katrina and Norman had actually been separated for 11 years at this point when the murders took place, but she still felt pretty sure that he was responsible. Now, that may seem crazy to you or to someone to think that you would point the finger at someone that you had not been in a relationship for the past 11 years. But if you feel that way, I mean, no disrespect, I am going to assume that you have never been in a highly abusive relationship before. The wounds of an abusive relationship can cut very, very deep and truly last a lifetime. So this did not surprise me at all that even after all these years, this ex-husband still had that tight of a grip on this poor woman. So back in August of 1991, so this is when Katrina was towards the end of her marriage to Norman. Katrina was leaving work when her then husband, Norman, approached her at knife point. He pushes her into the car and says, "Drive." He took her to a secluded area, he tied her up, and he raped her. After he finished, he untied her and told her to get the hell out of here. He had left the car keys in the car, so she took off in the car and went and reported the crime to the police. For 2 weeks, police looked for him. Norman would call their house and just taunt them, you know, saying things like how he was going to kill them all, just crazy crap like that. Finally, though, he was captured, arrested, and charged with kidnapping and rape. He pleads guilty to kidnapping and the rape charge is dropped. Unfortunately, though, police find him. Sorry. So that was what he was charged with when he attacked Katrina, his wife, who is, of course, the daughter of the two deceased folks. But now coming back to the murder of her parents, police were able to find Norman But they could not link him to the Ratliff murders. It turns out he had an airtight alibi. Like, doesn't get more airtight because he was 100 miles away in jail. So there's no BSing that one. He certainly was not responsible for the murders. So 2 weeks pass with no other suspects before police get Jimmy Lee Brooks Jr. plopped in their lap and he gives the confession. If it weren't for that, it is very, very possible this case would have gone cold and had never been solved, would never have been solved. At the time of Jimmy Lee Brooks' confession, James Gary was already locked up on some unrelated drug charges, so the cops had easy access to him. So James Gary confirms the story that Jimmy Lee Brooks Jr. tells, which was that he did not have money to pay back the bail bondsman of Michael Carruth. Along with Jimmy Lee Brooks, James Gary gives a full confession. He says that on the night of the Ratliff murders, Michael Carruth picks up James Gary and Jimmy Lee Brooks Jr. and takes them to the Ratliff's home. He drops them, well, takes them nearby. He drops them off nearby and gives them directions on what to do. Apparently, the last thing he said to them was, "If you have to kill him, kill him." James Gary and Jimmy Lee Brooks Jr. kick in the back door. They throw Mr. Ratliff to the ground and scream at him, "Where's the cash?" Mr. Ratliff says, "There is none," and they shoot him in the hand. Catherine Ratliff, who hears all this commotion, starts running down the hall to get her own gun that she kept in her house, and she ends up getting into a physical fight with Jimmy Lee Brooks. Of course, I mean, she's a 67-year-old woman, and he's a younger man. So he is easily able to overpower her, and she falls to her knees and starts begging and praying for him to spare her life. Jimmy Lee Brooks then shoots her in the head. Jimmy Lee Brooks then tells James Gary he must shoot and kill Thurman Ratliff, so that they both have blood on their hands, or that, you know, both their hands are dirty. James Gary fires one shot into the lower back of Mr. Ratliff. Jimmy Lee Brooks then takes the weapon and shoots Mr. Ratliff again, killing him. Only then do they start looking for money. So it's not like a robbery gone bad. I mean, the first thing they did was come in shooting, which, it doesn't matter, but it's like even more disturbing, I guess. You know? I don't know. Anyways, so money was found in the vent of the air conditioner and the hallway. They were able to steal between $25,000 and $30,000, but I think I had mentioned this earlier, that when the cops were searching, they found, it was either 80 or 85,000. Sorry, I can't remember off the top of my head, but these two clowns missed 80,000 or 85,000 that was hidden in the bathroom. Now, you may be asking yourself where the hell Michael Carruth was during all of this. Well, he was too busy to participate in the home invasion that day. You see, after he dropped them off, he went to wash his car. Yes. While his two little minions were killing the Ratliffs, Michael Carruth was washing his vehicle. Once the job was complete, they called Carruth to come pick them up, they split up the money, and they go home. They almost got away with this too. If it weren't for their greed for more money, they may have never been caught. Michael David Carruth, the mastermind, and Jimmy Lee Brooks, one of his minions, were tried separately but received the same sentence for their role in the murder of Brett Boyer, the attempted murder of Butch Boyer, robbery, and kidnapping. They were both sentenced to death. James Edward Gary Jr. was sentenced to life without parole in August of 2005 for his role in the robbery and murders of Thurman and Catherine Ratliff. Michael Carruth and Jimmy Lee Brooks Jr. were supposed to be tried at a later date for their role in the Ratliff robbery and murders. But I couldn't find any evidence that that trial actually occurred. I read somewhere that since the two had already been sentenced to death, that the outcome wouldn't change for them. So there was, even if they were found guilty, which they would have, I'm sure, in the Ratliff robbery and murders, the outcome wouldn't change for the two since they're already sentenced to death. So I read somewhere that that's why the trial never happened, because it would be an, I don't want to say an extra expense, but I think that's probably exactly what they were thinking, which I guess makes some sense in a very logical way. But what about the family of the Ratliffs? Can you imagine how they feel knowing that three people participated in this crime and only one of them was sentenced for it? Like, that would be very disturbing, even if the other two were already sentenced to death. Like, I wouldn't feel like my mom and dad, if I were Katrina, received justice. But I don't know. Do you agree? What do you guys think? Yeah, that would really, really make me furious. But anyways, okay, guys. Well, that is it for this week. I hope that you guys have a wonderful weekend and a wonderful Easter if you celebrate. And that's it. Have a fantastic day and an even better week ahead. Take care. Bye, guys.